Jesus has been in the synagogue. He had just finished teaching the disciples about the bread to come down from heaven. And after hearing it, many of the followers of Jesus said, "This is intolerable language. How could anyone accept it?" Well, Jesus was aware that his followers were complaining about it and said, "It is the Spirit that gives life. The flesh has nothing to offer. The words I have spoken to you are spirit and they are life. But there are some of you who do not believe. This is why I told you that no one could come to me unless it is granted by God." After this, many of the disciples left and stopped going with Jesus. So Jesus asked the 12, "Do you also wish to go away?" Shimon Kepha, Simon Peter, answered him, "Lord, to whom would we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to trust and grown to know that you are the Holy One of God."
Thank you, Roger. I am so glad the New Testament of the Bible has four Gospels, four different portrayals and interpretations and meanings of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John differ in ways large and small. But one characteristic of John's Gospel is that Jesus always had control over every situation. Just like here. Hi, bud.
Hello.
In John's Gospel, throughout the Gospel, Jesus is confident in every challenge. He uses every situation as a teaching moment. And it's unlike what we see in say, Mark, who has a very human portrayal of Jesus, where he just seems to almost be making this Messiah thing up as he goes along from challenge to challenge, healing the sick and teaching it in pithy little parables. While in John's Gospel, Jesus is always aware of being the Son of God and teaching in these long philosophical speeches while he always seems to be walking a few inches above the human fray. I have to admit that sometimes I find John's portrayal of Jesus the hardest one to connect to. He's so perfect. He's so smooth. He's so strong. He's so invulnerable. He doesn't lose his composure. He doesn't lose his cool until this reading. In today's gospel reading, Jesus has just finished this long sermon with a lot of difficult teachings about bread as a literal thing, people coming to eat, and as a spiritual metaphor. And he used language about eating my flesh and drinking my blood that was strange and graphic and even a little gory. He's angered the Jewish authorities. He's alienated those folks who came out to hear him and be fed by him literally. And in today's reading, he's even turned off many of his disciples. "This teaching is difficult," they say. "Who can accept it?" Many are leaving this strange rabbi behind. He's too different. He's too dangerous. And John writes, "Because of this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer went about with him." In my mind, I can almost smell the grief in Jesus' heart as he looks out at the atrophied crowds, the backs of followers walking away, as he turns to the 12 closest followers and friends and asks, "Do you also wish to go away?" Isn't that our greatest fear? That we open ourselves up to another. We show a side of ourselves that's imperfect and disheveled. We tell our deepest truths, our darkest fears. We risk being vulnerable to another human being, and they leave. Too close. Nope. Too vulnerable. Nope. You are not what I thought you were. Nope. You do not meet my expectations. Nope. You are a fraud. Nope. Not going with you. And there's that voice inside that says, "Oh, I knew it. I knew that would happen. I knew they would go." There's an insecure part of us that just is ready for the other to recognize that we aren't who we're projecting ourselves to be. There's a really scared part of me that every morning when I wake up and I see that Barb is still next to me in bed, she hasn't, in the middle of the night, gone, "Enough." So I can start the day anew. Jesus asks, "Do you also wish to go away?" And Peter, God bless him, usually so quick to say exactly the wrong thing, to say something shallow and stupid and entirely missing the point, he says precisely the right thing. Give the man a medal. It's never happened. "Rabbi," he says, "where else would we go?" Peter manages, despite himself, to let Jesus know that despite the costs of following, despite knowing the consequences, they will continue to stay, not despite of, but because of who Jesus is in his deepest self. It's been 3 years. We know who you are, and we will follow. You have the words of eternal life. We have come to trust and grown to know that you are the Holy One of God. St. Paul, in his second letter to the church at Corinth, shares rather vulnerably a place of pain and weakness that God will not remove from him. He described it as a thorn in his side, and we don't know what it was. But what Paul understands it to mean is that God is saying to Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in your weakness. My power is made perfect in weakness." Paul shares the deep spiritual truth that often it is out of our most vulnerable places that God is able to do God's best work through us. But it's not the easiest spiritual path. When I was 5 years old, we were living in Newport, Rhode Island. And I lost a baby sister. Her name was Kristen Jade. I never got to meet her because she never came home from the hospital. They say her death was preventable and was caused by serious negligence on behalf of some Navy doctors. My mom tried to put the death behind her. There is apparently a gravestone in Newport, Rhode Island. I've never seen it. There was no funeral. And we very, very seldom talk about it. But once in a while, I wonder what it would have been like to have a kid sister. And what kind of sister she would have been. And now in our 50s, what kind of mom would she have been? And what kind of aunt to my children? In some very deep ways, my mom never healed from the loss of her only daughter. There's a deep well of grief just under the surface, so it's not a topic we broach. But for the last couple of decades, after my brother and I left the house for college and seminary and for a job out west, my mom started making connections in her community with girls with special needs. In Illinois and then in Kansas, she would find one girl that seemed to have no one else to go to bat for her. And she would become that person for that little girl. Now, I know the psychology underneath it. My mom is feeling an emotional loss with these new relationships with someone who would have been like blah, 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 blah. I know that. But what's a lot more important is that I know the spiritual reality underneath it as well. God's grace, God's power, God's love is able to shine through my mom's most vulnerable and fragile place. God's strength is made perfect in her weakness. This week, I put on my Facebook page an interview in, of all places, GQ magazine, not exactly one I read very often, but an interview with Stephen Colbert, who most of you know gave up a show where he played a right-wing blowhard with so little ability to be introspective or self-critical that he was emotionally invulnerable, and that was part of the humor of the show. And it was a great device for a bunch of years for political comedy. His character was a perfect foil to poke folk at the real-life TV bloviators and radio bloviators. But on the new show, as he takes over for Letterman, he won't have a character. He will be the real Stephen Colbert. And we all wonder, who will that be? Who is this guy? Well, there's a hint of who this guy is in the GQ magazine this month. In the article, we learn that he was the youngest of 11 children. Bless his mom. All but three of the kids were out of the house. Work, school, blah. But at age 10, Colbert's father and two brothers, though two brothers who were still at home, were all killed in a plane crash. This house went from 11 to Stephen and his mom. It was a huge wound. Now that kind of woundedness is a rich place for a lot of comedians to dig a lifetime of dark humor out of. From Robin Williams to whomever, you will find they are the most wounded people. The line between depression and comedy is really fine. But Stephen Colbert doesn't stay in that place. He has a note taped to his computer, or did at the old show, that reads, "Joy is the most infallible sign of the existence of God." And he's learned that to get beyond that place of paralyzing hurt is to enter into it and, get this, to love it. He said when he was at Second City, he had a director who said, "You have to learn to love the bomb." Meaning when you bomb on stage. He writes, "It took me a long time to really understand what that meant. It wasn't, 'Don't worry, you'll learn and get it next time.' It wasn't, 'Laugh it off.' No, it means what it says. You've got to learn to love when you're failing. The embracing of that, the discomfort of failing in front of an audience, leads you to penetrate through the fear that blinds you." If any of you read the Dune trilogy, he says, fear is the mind killer. He says that he is so grateful to be alive, even though I know a lot of dead people, he says. That urge to be grateful is not, he says, it's not a function of his faith. It's not the gospel tells us, and therefore we give thanks. It is what he has always felt because of his relationship with God. Grateful to be alive. And I'll read a quote here now. "And so that act, that impulse to be grateful, wants an object. That object I call God." Now, that could be many things. I was raised in a Catholic tradition. I'll start there. That's my context for my existence. It is that I am here to know God, love God, serve God, that we might be happy with each other in this world and with him in the next, the catechism. That makes a lot of sense to me. I got that from my mom and my dad and my siblings. And this poor interviewer, secular guy, just blown away by this.
Right.
Not even knowing the language. He said his mom was broken, but not bitter. And she had to be that for him. That in those days of unremitting grief, she drew on her faith. That the only way to not be swallowed by sorrow, to in fact recognize that our sorrow is inseparable from our joy, is to always understand our suffering, ourselves, in the light of eternity. What is this in the light of eternity? Imagine being a parent so filled with your own pain, yet still being able to pass that on to your son. I love the thing that I most wish had not happened. I'll say that again. I love the thing that I most wish had not happened. It's not the same thing as wanting it to have happened, but you can't change everything about the world. You certainly can't change things that have already happened. Jean Vanier, who began the L'Arche community that works with mentally ill or mentally or developmentally disabled adult men in Montreal and Paris, one to be built in Maine, he says, "We so often want a Jesus who makes things right for the world. But Jesus wants us to make things right for the world. It's up to us, with the strength of the Spirit of Jesus, to give food to the hungry, to struggle for justice and peace, to be with those who are lonely, oppressed, and in pain, to reveal to them the good news of our friendship, and through his friendship, the good news that they are beloved of God." Jesus became vulnerable. The fancy Greek word is kenosis. Jesus poured himself out, emptying himself to be human. Vulnerable in obedience even to a cross. And he repeatedly and over again calls us to the same thing. Jesus, I wish he hadn't said that. The only reason to do this vulnerability thing, the only reason to learn how to love that thing you most wish hadn't happened, the only reason to open ourselves up to the possibility of more pain and rejection is that it's the only way that God can really use us. That's just reality. It is only by entering into and embracing our own pain that we can enter the pain of others. It is only by knowing the healing that I've met in the rabbi from Nazareth that I can share that healing with another person. My strength is made perfect, or God says, my strength is made perfect in weakness. I invite you to an exercise for a couple of minutes if it feels safe for you. But I invite you to take a minute to think about the place where you've been most vulnerable, or the place of pain, where God has used that to help you connect to another. Where have you entered your own pain that you could enter someone else's? Think about that for a minute, and if it feels safe, share that with a person nearby. And I'll offer up a prayer. Let's take a few minutes to think on that. I want to finish up with a prayer by Malcolm Gwite or Gwite. About how God is so different from the gods of our expectation. Pray with me. They, the gods of our making, they sought to soar into the skies, those classic gods of high renown. From lofty pride aspires to rise. But you came down. You dropped down from the mountains sheer, forsook the eagle for the dove. The other gods demanded fear, but you gave love. Where chiseled marble seemed to freeze their abstract and perfected form, compassion brought you to your knees. Your blood was warm. They called for blood in sacrifice. Their victims on an altar bled. When no one else could pay the price, you died instead. They towered above our mortal plane, dismissed this restless flesh with scorn. Aloof from birth and death and pain. But you were born. Born to these burdens, born by all, born with us all astride the grave. Weak to be with us when we fall, and strong to save.